That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
That is you at the Weekly. That's how Canute used to talk to his reporters at the Weekly. That's right, sapheads. Not you, but you guys.
Okay.
That's how Skip would talk. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. It's all about being an ink-stained wretch. Canute Berger used to yell at his reporters when he was at the Weekly, and now he writes at the crosscut.com as the Mossback. You're much mellower, probably. Just all that
much,
moss
much,
on your back.
Much, much mellower.
Yeah. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, did you wag your finger a few times at some of the folks you worked with?
I think I was on the other side of the finger wagging.
And Jody Balter with the Seattle Times, you probably
lots of wagging, yeah, directions.
Skip brought in a bag of a candy. Is that because you just think we should eat more Milky Ways?
You know, I live in an apartment complex, and no children ever come to our remote, dark, scary unit, I guess. So, but I always buy a little bit of candy just in case that one kid shows up. And I always figure I can't eat it, so I figure I'll take it in and share it with people at work.
You know, you got to turn the light on, maybe carve a pumpkin.
Show some enthusiasm. Yeah.
They're not just going to go up to a dark door with some guy's gonna,
door. Yeah.
Their parents have taught them not to do that.
You gotta join in the fun.
Well, you know, I mean, these days, like in Madison Park, it was like Mardi Gras down there, except everybody was 3 or 4 years old with their parents, and they go trick or treating at the local merchants, and it was an amazing scene.
That's fun.
Oh, I would have loved that when I was a kid.
Oh yeah,
cool.
Trick-or-treaters.
There were very few, and I was thinking this whole bowl of candy and no trick-or-treaters. And then a pack of 10 8-year-olds showed up, and there was almost no candy left after that experience.
Because dole them out or stick your hands in there?
They can go either way they want. I did have the experience one year where some older trick-or-treaters took the whole bowl, including the bowl. So I hold a little tighter than I had before that.
Trick-or-treaters, Eli?
My boyfriend and I went down to see Psycho at Benaroya Hall with the Seattle Symphony playing the score.
Oh, yeah.
It was great and scary.
Yeah.
I had not seen that movie.
So then you need the candy.
Toss it over here.
Yeah.
Because such a good catch last time.
You're obviously the one that didn't get to get any candy, because we had our share.
Did you?
Yeah, we had a good run. It was fun, mostly early and younger kids. And then there was one kid who was beating on our window. And I opened up the door. I said, yeah, you can knock on the door. And he just kept beating on the window. I said, you've had too much candy. And he took more.
Because you let him have easy access to the bowl. We've already established that.
Easy access is the way to go. All right. A couple of good memes around Washington, D.C. this week, just to ask you about. What did the president know and when did he know it? Is that an important question to be asking right now?
Well, it's a dreadful question if you're the president. No president, you know. I mean, you never want to be caught in that Washington scandal, which is you're either evil or incompetent. And this is a problem that a meme that has come up in relation both to healthcare and the NSA spying accusations. Obama says he didn't know that they were tapping Andrea Merkel's phone. Says he didn't know that the healthcare site was not ready for prime time. And so he's been in this position of having to defend his lack of knowledge. It may be that he was misled. It may be I suspect on the NSA stuff that that knowing is technical.
Yeah, I bet.
It's you didn't know because you didn't want to know and you didn't ask the questions, but he gets the intelligence every day. He gets an intelligence briefing, and you would have to be indulging in an incredible lack of curiosity not to know where specific pieces of intelligence are coming from. But you also have a great incentive not to know, because one, it would be scandalous if you did and allowed it to continue, But the nature of the information that we get from spying on our friends and enemies is such that it's addictive to power. That I remember when Henry Kissinger left, somebody asked him if he missed the power of being the Secretary of State. He says, "I don't miss the power. I miss the information."
Oh, that's funny.
Miss the data.
Well, for Obama, it was an unfortunate, shall we say, mix of events, because he kept saying, "I didn't know." My staff maybe knew, I didn't know. But there's a difference a little bit here between the NSA and the healthcare didn't know. First of all, you don't want to be president clueless. That's not a good way to go.
Well, he's running for that this week, the way he's talking.
Correct. But here's the thing. On the his signature piece of legislation is healthcare reform. We had, just go back 1 month, we had the Republicans ready to shut down the government and Obama saying, give my healthcare a chance. And what a seesaw it's been, you know, because it went from, well, if you want to go back even further, it went from the quagmire over Syria, then it goes to, which the Democrats were having a rough time on, which went to the shutdown, which was really awful for the Republicans. And then it was supposed to be quiet around here, but then comes this storm over the rollout of health care. And you have a president who said for the second time in less than a month, I didn't know. It's rough stuff.
But that review of the last few months reminds that the channel changes in the public's mind very quickly and within the course of a month. Say.
So you mean it doesn't matter?
Well,
it may not matter.
It may not matter. He's set on healthcare. He's set a deadline of November 30th, and this thing is going to be fixed by then. If it's not, that's a huge problem.
Well, what does he do? I mean, the man has made deadlines and then avoided them. What does he do with a deadline like that, do you think?
He meets it. I don't think he has a choice. And he's assembled this sort of tech dream team, so
yes,
presumably he can. On the other question, the NSA spying, I think the other issue is what else does Glenn Greenwald have and when is he going to release it? And how much
Glenn
more?
Greenwald, the journalist who's right, who got most of the stuff from Snowden,
right,
and is parsing it out to various media organizations from his safe haven in South America.
Right, slowly and methodically. And I think part of what he's doing is letting administration officials take positions in response to what's been released and then releasing things that undermine what they've said. And so given that, you know, you could understand why President Obama might want to continue with some plausible deniability, and that is unfortunately the way the game is played, and we may not know the answer.
It's KUOW's Week in Review with Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knut Berger.
Didn't Obama say that they had turned off the sort of listening of Angela Merkel? Didn't they do that to a point? Then some people knew, of course it wasn't him, but then some people knew and they turned that off like in the summer. So some of it stopped. Now they're doing a review.
Well, sure. And he could also say, well, you know, it started in before I was
started
president.
In the Bush administration.
Here's what I'll tell you. I think the idea of spying on our allies, tapping their cell phones or intercepting the broadcast and all that, I don't think most Americans have a terrible problem with that, frankly. And I think that in some ways, I think it would be better if Obama just went Dick Cheney on it and just said, hey, you know, our friends are also our enemies or potential enemies. We need to know what they're up to. There are competitors as well. But with diplomacy, once everybody, even if everybody's doing something, once you get exposed, you have to deny it or you have to make adjustments and apologize and that kind of thing. I don't think that's the big worry. I mean, the other revelation this week was that the NSA has interrupted fiber optic cable so that they can access Google and
Yahoo, all those big
Yahoo servers and whatnot, and the fear was that they were getting into the servers, but it turns out, at least from what we're hearing, that they don't need the servers; they have other ways of getting access to that information. And I think as far as American citizens go, or people in general, that's probably a bigger concern than what kind of scheme the Germans are hatching economically or whatever.
Eli?
Oh, I was just going to say that I think that, though, is where the concern about heads of state can kind of merge around and infect the discussion about spying on Americans. I mean, basically, I think people will say, well, if the government is capable of tapping into Angela Merkel's phone, what are they doing to me? And there's been so many revelations about what the government is doing or suspected of doing. I think it's not as simple as Americans just being fine with the United States government spying on Merkel. I think it registers an alarm in terms of the capability at home as well.
Well, what I read was this originated with Angela Merkel, and it originated with some concerns about the Eurozone, of all things, going way back. And my question at the time was, why didn't they just call her up and ask her, so what's going on with the Eurozone, and what are you saying, and what are you thinking, instead of, I mean, you know, she probably would have answered. Anybody try that?
Well, there's an issue of collaboration, right, between Spain is a government that looks like it worked with the U.S. National Security Agency on this. We don't know what kind of collaboration took place, World Bank, Merkel, yet we don't know. As you say, we may have more revelations. But what's happening in this country is also about collaboration. Yahoo, Google, now they're taking steps to have more encryption because they say they didn't know. But do Americans, I mean, are we throwing up our hands at this point? That's what I'm wondering. And saying, well, this is, there is no privacy. Are we giving up on it?
Okay, Berger's law is that if there is any piece of technology will be used for evil if it exists. Okay, and so I don't think whenever we see technology, we can expect that it will be used at some point by someone in a damaging way. So I think people are completely right to be concerned about how to limit or control or have some accountability. And so I think the idea of finding out what's actually going on, what has oversight, what doesn't. It's clearly something that needs to be worked out. And the way these things get worked out is usually through overreach or through scandal, through something being exposed and corrective measures taking place. But there is a genie that, you know, is a toothpaste in the tube that we're not going to put back?
You can't put the genie back in the tube, though. That's, yeah, I just don't want you to do
or
that.
Or the cows in the barn. you know, it's the same with nuclear power or, any other technological advance. I don't think there's a way that if the technology is capable of something, you have to be able to attempt to control it, but you're going to have these problems. I think a lot of this is a legacy of the sort of overreaction after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the kind of imposition of a national security state that is now going too far, and it's up to the American people to let those guys know they are going too far.
But who has a Google account, email account, that doesn't know and hasn't known for some time that information, they are crawling over that for business purposes all the time? They've been doing that for years. So who has such an account that didn't know that?
But the assumption is that Google crawls over your information and doesn't share it with, say, the government. And that's another thing that works in favor of this getting worked out. You now have these very, very wealthy companies who have a lot of influence, by the way, on Capitol Hill in D.C. and with the Obama administration, saying they feel burned by this, that this is undermining their business model. And so I think that will work to the benefit of some controls on this.
I want to come back to that, what the damage is for the president and for those people who are hoping to have privacy and health care. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. We're here with Knut Berger, with Eli Sanders, with Joni Balter. You can write us, weekinreview@kuow.org. Like to hear what you think about this question of privacy and, moreover, if it matters, what the president knew and when did he know it.
Hi, this is Liz Jones. KUOW welcomes all the new and renewing members who took part in our recent membership drive. Thank you for making this drive so successful. When you receive your pledge reminder in the mail, please be sure to return it as soon as you can. And thanks again for all your support.
54 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 57 and expecting clouds pretty much all day. Then rain coming in overnight with a low of 48. Tomorrow, Saturday, windy with rain expected in the morning and showers in the afternoon. Tomorrow's high just 51.
Support for KUOW comes from Dignity Memorial, hosting events in Everett and Seattle Tuesday, November 5th, featuring author on end-of-life care for veterans, Deborah Grassman. More information at dignitymemorialseattle.com.
You're tuned to the Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. Glad you're here. Knut Berger's here. He writes at Crosscut, Seattle Magazine. Author of Pugetopolis. Eli Sanders is here, writes at The Stranger, working on a major book. I can say that, right?
Ooh.
Is that scary if I say that?
The major part.
Okay.
Oh, but, come on. All books are major, right? You read like, come
on.
On
a little
come
book.
On.
I actually should have asked you beforehand if I
That's fine.
All right.
I am.
Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. How's that? We like that.
I'll take Joni
Balter is here at the Seattle Times, working on some stuff.
That's
and
right.
Thanks. Monday, the Seattle Public Library is allowing people to bring their licensed guns into the libraries. So we were wondering, for the record, if you're a licensed gun owner, do you bring your gun into public places? And why or why not? And do you think gun owners should be allowed to carry guns in public places? We're going to talk about that on the record. So give us a call at 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. And I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. We'll talk about that later today. We might touch on that as well in this hour. I want to ask you about one aspect of the what the president knew and when did he know it sort of thing, which I wonder if this is the thing that'll have legs. The president made promises during the campaign and afterwards and said, you know, if you like your health care, you can keep it. If you like insurance, you can keep it. Now, New York Times, many major news organizations featuring people who have to give up their health care. The sub story of that, of course, is that healthcare always changes. There's new plans rolled out. Old plans are canceled. People have been losing their health care for a long time. But is that promise, is that going to weigh on the way we feel about the Affordable Care Act in the months ahead?
Well, all you have to do is keep replaying that clip where the president said what you just said. If you like your health care, you get to keep it. It's not going to change. But what happened is in the individual market, some of the plans don't meet the rules, the higher thresholds, the higher provisions of Obamacare. And so those go through a year and then they're canceled. And so that promise, that clip that you would keep playing over and over again, becomes something that the president said too strongly. He ran into that, if you think about it, on Syria with his red line. So while he's professing to be endlessly clueless here, he's also making these specific promises that sound good when you hear them that he may or may not be able to keep.
Well, that's why I was worried about the November 30th thing if you were President Obama.
Well, back on the keeping your health plan statement, while it's not literally true, well, yes, you do get bumped off your plan if your plan doesn't conform, if it's not meeting these higher thresholds. The point is that you end up on a better plan because the new plan has to meet these higher thresholds. And so if there weren't so many people committed to sabotaging healthcare reform, which is what the Republicans, you know, openly say they're doing, then you wouldn't have such a focus on the, you know, literal phrasing of something that overall makes a point that Americans might be happy to hear, that they are moving. Yes, their plan gets canceled, but the cancellation letter doesn't mean they're kicked off healthcare permanently, which is what people are implying. They just move to something that is probably going to be more helpful for
right.
them.
Right. And the fact is that the whole point of the healthcare plan is to make sure that everybody can get affordable insurance. So the number of people affected ends up being about 3% of people who have their plans canceled because they don't conform to the Obamacare strategies and then have to go back and find a new plan. And in some cases, those plans are more expensive. So it affects a very small number of people. And I think the idea that Obama should have put an asterisk on his statement saying that, you can keep your insurance if your insurance company will let you, a lot of insurance companies, there's a significant number of insurance companies that canceled their plans, but reinstated plans that were virtually identical. And there are more inexpensive options on the healthcare markets.
But you think that's going to resonate? I mean, you read the New York Times this morning, or if you didn't, here's a guy who now has to pay $12,000 in a high cost plan and a much higher deductible than he had before, and he's the guy that they're going to go to. He'll be in the ad in a year from now in that state's congressional district.
Yeah, there are going to be complaints. Not everybody is going to be happy with the change. But you have to contrast that against how many people were happy with the existing insurance market. I mean, there were many, many, many millions more people unhappy with the price increases, with not being able to get coverage, or not even, you know, not being able to get coverage, not just because of a pre-existing condition, but I mean, I remember, you know, what, 5-6 years ago when I went off Cobra and had to go in the individual market, there was almost nothing available. They didn't want to sell individual plans. So, yeah, it can hurt him in the same way that you can take, you know, I mean, that whole stupid thing about how Al Gore apparently claimed to have invented the internet, which he never did. But you can take a line like that and you know, turn it into a political sledgehammer. And this, yeah, I'm sure they can do that. I mean, they've taken something that's extraordinarily beneficial to the vast majority of Americans and are trying to turn it into, you know, the biggest thing since Hitler.
When the history of this law is written, it's going to talk about how poorly explained this big, complicated law was. So from the beginning, the health care, just even how it would work from the beginning before it didn't work type thing, was poorly explained. So someone, and I don't know who, could be explaining what you've all said here this morning, which is that, yes, you cannot have the same plan that did not meet the standards, but it will be replaced by one that does meet the standards. You might even like it better. And depending, and this is the war of anecdotes that we're about to watch, many years of them, I guess, but it's going to vary state by state whether it's a good deal or a bad deal. It depends on the, sort of how organized and how much competition there is in each state. Washington, just by the way, ranks, like, I think, number 3 out of all the states for just having, and it's not perfect at all. There's been some problems there, too. But it ranks roughly number 3 in the whole country for just in how it's providing health care for folks.
Joni makes a really great point, and I think it's one of the reasons that in some ways single payer would have been an easier sell conceptually, and because it's just so much simpler. And I mean, the fact is, the numbers in terms of the number of people predicted to be that were going to have their insurance plans canceled, et cetera, were all predicted. They were all published by the government 3 years ago. So the details about which percentage of people were going to fall into which categories in terms of coverage and whatnot was all laid out. He was, you know, I mean, his own operation was putting those numbers out.
Laid out but not explained, and not explained in a way that people would know.
And well, I think right. that there's some fair criticism there.
The problem is that this is very, very complicated and very hard to explain to people. To go back to single payer, it would have been much more simple. The problem with single payer is it's much more socialist, or at least it can be branded as much more socialist. And in the political climate that we have in this country, you've seen how that scares people. And so you end up with this, which is much more complicated to explain. And I think part of the strategy has been, I'm not sure we can explain this. You know, we can rely on the media to do some explaining, but that's not happening as well as it could. And so the best thing to do is wait for people to experience it themselves and see what it is and explain it to their friends and so on. And that's why the botched rollout is so unfortunate. But perhaps after November 30th, when people can get online and figure this out for themselves and get their insurance and hopefully see that the sky hasn't fallen, a lot of this will fade away. You know, we're talking about when the history of this is written. Think about Medicare Part D. That was a bumpy rollout. No one probably even remembers what Medicare Part D and its rollout was like. Half the people don't know what Medicare Part D even is. But when you look back at the comments about that, when it was rolled out in the Bush administration, and you can go online and find these, there were a lot of Republicans in Congress, the same ones who are yelling about Obama right now, Republicans in Congress saying, well, it takes time with these things. When you make a major change to a healthcare system, it's going to be bumpy. There are going to be glitches. I mean, these are their words. And so it could be that this, in retrospect, is seen as glitches, unfortunate glitches, in something that turned out to be a huge change and beneficial overall for the American people.
I get that. I'm trying to figure out, back to that question of, you have a signature piece of legislation, you want to march it through so it's up and ready to go, and you wait until it fails to assemble a tech dream team.
Well, that's a
well. Did you see the thing
mistake,
that they only tested it for 2 weeks? You know, that isn't. I don't know how to build one of these things myself, but I would just say that that doesn't sound like enough time to test load and interactiveness between a bunch of different sites. And, you know, so they were grilling Kathleen Sebelius yesterday, and the big picture was of that thing that says the healthcare website is down now. Please try later. I mean, so anything she said was
right. Of course, that's all theater for the folks who are holding the hearings too. Of course,
well, but yes, it is. It is. And everybody's covering it. There's no question. It was a huge screw up.
Yeah,
I mean, it just was, and they're trying to fix it. That's all they can do. All they can do. They can't paper it over. They can't. All they can do is fix it.
But my question is about its connection back to NSA spying, drone strikes, whether the amount of effort put into clamping down on leakers. I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of who is this administration. I mean, who is President Obama?
Well, what is incredible is that we can tap Angela Merkel's phone, but we can't put up a website that will process.
and got to move those people.
And this is exactly where a lot of the conspiracy theories and the dark things, you know, fall apart, which is, you know, we're not competent enough to do some of the great conspiracy. You would think that if the NSA were smart, they would say, let us build the website. We'll just integrate all the information in one vast database.
That's a very good idea.
And it'll all be done.
Actually, you know? They've already done that.
Except the problem is the NSA hired the wrong guy and gave him access to the information so he could.
So they say you're no longer on the Angela Merkel thing. You are now moved over to make that website say, "Happy to see you. What can I do for you?"
Well, I guess to address your question, I don't think you can simplistically define the Obama administration by a couple of screw-ups. Exactly. I think the issues are more complicated than that. I think we don't know what his ultimate legacy will be because there's three more years to go. So there's a lot of time left. These are clearly political problems for him. And the unfortunate thing is they're happening. And the reason why they're being, I think, in some ways amplified is because they're occurring in a toxic political environment in Washington that makes solving the problems more difficult. You have people actively trying to sabotage solutions. And so I think that puts him in a real bind. I think it would put almost any president in a bind.
Yeah, but he was cruising out of the shutdown thinking, you know, I really handled that pretty well. And then he gets to this healthcare thing. There's no doubt this is one of the bumpier moments in this presidency. There's just no doubt the two or three things combined.
But it's not like he was cruising out of the shutdown not knowing that he was about to slam into this. This was, you know, burbling or on a high boil even during the shutdown. And so it's just, again, a huge mistake that they knew was coming. And as Knut was saying, they can't do anything but fix it.
I get that. I guess for me, I come back to that question of what's the Snowden documents reveal and the policies that this administration has pursued compared to the previous administrations.
Well, I think there's a national security apparatus in place that exists no matter who's president, and that no president has complete control over it. We also know that Congress does not have complete oversight over it, despite assurances and promises. So the oversight thing, I think, is a real issue. But America is in an international game of where defense and economics are inextricably intertwined. And a lot of this stuff, I think, has been going on a long time. We've been doing illegal spying for a long time. What was the U-2 spy plane that Russia shot down? We know about that. We know our allies have been doing that kind of stuff. So there's a whole kind of game going on. And you don't get to be president unless you're willing at some level to play that
game. Yeah. I talked to a scholar earlier this week whose argument was that they can get out of this bind with more transparency. That's what they, we always end up going there. More transparency. Reveal your information. Talk to the American people what you're doing. When you're not saying something, say, I'm not saying it, American people. Think that works?
Or do you think? Are they doing this to say, you know, we hatched much of this in response to 9/11, and we're trying to keep you safe? And that sort of worked for the first round.
Yeah.
And then now to say, I mean, that doesn't explain Angela Merkel, I don't think, one bit, but it's a way of talking to the public. So there's a lot of this comes down to how do you talk to the public about the things you're doing? Healthcare, NSA, talk to people.
Here's a couple of emails. I really don't care what Obama or any president knows about my personal affairs as revealed in my email. It's all just gossip to him. I do care, Pat writes, what the attorney general and others in intelligence, law enforcement know about my activist connections. I lived through J. Edgar Hoover, McCarthy era. I lived through and was active in the civil rights, Vietnam, Iraq war protest eras. COINTELPRO and Dick Cheney's TIPS programs are alive and well in the fusion centers. Those plus overreaching INS customs agents at the border mean we have little or no liberty because we've allowed the proponents of safety at all costs to reign again. And then Carl writes, first call me naive, but I don't believe the NSA spying. The NSA is listening to my phone calls or reading my email. Obviously, there's no way they have staff or time to really spy. What happens at NSA computers, look for patterns and phone numbers, contacting each other, then the NSA is interested in the content or the call of the email if a known or suspected terrorist shows up. If there is another terrorist attack within the U.S., I'll be interested to hear how many talking heads will jump on the CIA and NSA for not detecting the communications between the terrorists and stopping the attack before it occurred. I mean, we do go back and forth on this security and privacy issue.
This is a pendulum that's swinging back and forth, and right now it's swinging away from people being willing to give up a lot of civil liberties in the name of national security. Another thing that's worth just throwing out there, some of the response to all of this reflects the way that all of us have come to not be able to imagine living without email or the internet for organizing. You know, the person who's talking about political beliefs being monitored makes a very good point, but it's worth keeping in mind for a very long time, including during the American Revolution, people found ways to organize without email and without the internet. And so there are some answers, like go sit in a meeting and talk to people.
Yeah, well,
but not on airplanes.
I'll
until
kind of
now.
Figured some of that out. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and talk about some of the local issues on the Week in Review. I'm Steve Scherer, Knute Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders are here. And your email is weekinreview@kuow.org.
The NSA has done it now. Sure, go ahead and listen to everybody's phone calls. We're all texting anyway. But now they've spied on Google, and Google is mad. Hope you like Duluth, NSA guys, because that's where Google Maps is sending you every time. I'm Peter Sagal. We're inviting everybody but the NSA to listen into this week's show. Wait, wait, don't tell me. From NPR.
Be part of that exclusive audience tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Custom Pure, the water store, providing water filters for the kitchen and bath with home and office installation and service since 1981. Located in Shoreline and online at CustomPure.com.
...55 degrees and mostly cloudy across the Seattle area. Forecast says expect clouds all day with a high of 57 and then rain coming in overnight with an overnight low in the upper 40s. It's 10:40.
It's the Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherer. We look at the news of the week. You know, We record one bit of extra material that shows up on the record, brand new, fresh. We unwrap it on the record at about 1:15, I think, today. I may be wrong. So do check that out as well. And then we'll remind you then to listen to this show as well. We just go back and forth. Week in Review at KUOW.org. We'd like to hear what you're thinking about some of the big stories that have popped up in your radar. Here's one that I've been thinking about. It started with the 522 ads and what is being said by some of the people in those ads.
I've seen the actors promoting Initiative 522 and ads paid for by out-of-state special interests.
I know we don't know the answer, but there's another clip that Ken Eikenberry also delivers where he says the paid actors. And we asked, who gets paid? You know, who are the paid actors? Are they on both sides? We got an email yesterday from somebody who said, you know, I was the big government actor in the Yes on 522. And you can bet I got paid union wages for that job. So I just was wondering.
Maybe some public officials are doing it, you know, on their own because they believe in the cause.
Maybe.
Possibly, but I actually don't know that.
You know, we talked about a few years ago, I was suggesting that the business model of initiatives is basically, it's like an economic model of getting out-of-state groups to spend vast quantities, the trial lawyers or the chemical companies or what, to spend vast numbers, amounts of money here on media. It wouldn't surprise me if the, you know, initiatives were backed by the TV stations.
Well.
There's your conspiracy theory of the day. Because, you know, tens of millions of dollars. I mean, we have a bunch of races that a lot of outside political money is coming in on. We have, you know, the GMO vote, but you've also got lots of money coming in. Even the mayor's race, a lot of money's coming into PACs surrounding that, and it's not all out of state. But
and to the 26th legislative district, which is control of the legislature.
And CTAC. And the $15 Proposition 1 and CTAC for $15 an hour minimum wage. There are a lot of these real hot, and they're getting, it's interesting to see how they're getting national publicity because of that, because some of these races have consequence outside the state.
It makes you wonder why Cuomo has to lay off so many journalists when they're bringing in all this money.
I was just going to say that. The TV stations are the biggest beneficiary of the incredible spending on these races. And then there was the news this week, or maybe it was last week, that Cuomo, having recently been bought by a very large conservative conglomerate of TV stations nationwide, is now downsizing its reporters here in Seattle and in Portland, many of them union employees.
There's something to be said for local ownership sometimes.
James Fallows was in town yesterday, and he spoke at a Crosscut.
Journalist, writer, Atlantic.
Atlantic journalist, writer, worked at Microsoft for a while. and he was saying that in terms of the model of sort of, you know, in-depth, serious journalism, there's never been a sustainable economic model for that, that it has always simply attached itself to a host body, you know, that's making money. And so I was just laughing because, you know, we as editorial people think, wow, you know, Cuomo's making a lot of money. Why would they lay people off? Well, that's why you lay people off. You're making a lot of money. You can make that much more if you let a few people go.
Well, but there's another thing here about an initiative like 522 GMO labeling. You know, when your state passes things that get a lot of national attention, like last year's gay marriage and the pot legalization, people begin to think of you as sort of a little petri dish, so that they can try things there. So GMOs, as we all know, went down in California. Well, let's try that up in Washington and see if it maybe could pass there and spin out that way. And now you see the amount of money that is coming in. The last number I saw was $27
million. $27 million, that's what I saw, too.
But there are maybe even more numbers. But the point of that is...
For the GMO.
For the GMO. And you've seen now that the polls have swung dramatically against it.
I didn't see that.
There was an Elway poll
against it.
Not a majority, but
to a much tighter
from a 66 race. To 21 number to a 46 to 42, with Stuart Elway, the longtime pollster, saying he's never seen a swing like that. He's never seen money like that either.
Well, you could sure see the money if you watch television. The money is very powerful, and is that, you know, we've also had people claim, I think disingenuously, that money doesn't really play a big part in these campaigns. In the end, people make up their minds based on the facts. Usually the people who are spending the money say that.
I was going to say that, you know, anybody who really believes that is just dumb, because they wouldn't be spending the money if it didn't work. It doesn't always work. It's not a guarantee. It's just like you can have an ad campaign for New Coke and it wasn't successful. People didn't like the product. But so it's not a guarantee. But boy, yeah, it makes a huge difference. And it makes a huge difference in reaching people through a lot of different platforms, a lot of different techniques and strategies, a lot of which are very costly. Of the phone banks and the you know, the way that lists are generated and whatnot is very expensive.
And here's empirical evidence that it works in the 522 race, just the swing that Joni's talking about.
Were the polls, were there enough decent polls in the, you know, in the past 6 months, for example, that
yeah,
that,
you,
that
compare,
you trusted about
yeah,
how they were doing, how it was
Elway
doing?
To Elway. And Elway's a, you know, pretty reliable, respected pollster in this state, and you're seeing a swing of, I don't know, how many points was it?
It was like 20, 40 30, points.
40? It was a big swing. It had changed dramatically.
So what accounts for that? Tens of millions of dollars of TV advertising.
I think it's particularly effective when there is, you can, it's like with healthcare, you make something complicated, you make something scary. You make something, and it's about something that maybe, in the case of GMOs, none of us knows a whole lot about the science, or we don't know a lot about agriculture and how it's conducted today and that kind of thing. And so you end up with a case where people don't have strong convictions in large numbers, and you can scare them.
Well, there was never like a clear line, GMOs will do X to you. You know, I kept looking for that. There was never that. And then there was this counter argument that came up that was interesting as well. Why can't people who are clearly not having any GMOs in some product get their own stickers and use that as a way of selling, almost like organic, where you charge more for organic or you at least sort of make a big deal out of it, like the big word now and everything is artisan, artisan this, artisan that, but you say GMO free and maybe it's just a different argument. And I don't know if that's part of the swing, but
that does happen at some health food stores. I mean, particularly you'll see labeling saying GMO free. The problem with this is that the science is not clear. That to me is the problem. You have something that's relatively new, historically speaking, and science has not given us any sort of clear determination. And so you end up with these arguments about what might happen or what people think may be the problem. And then it just kind of gets boiled down to harm to business, which is the argument against, and the value of adding more information to food packaging, which is the argument for.
Well, it's a classic campaign. I mean, this campaign is one that they've succeeded in the past, and it's almost been refined. As you say, confuse, scare, and keep that message going.
It reminds me of the one on the beverage tax a couple of years ago, because it's the same sort of just this huge bomb of money, and you just talk people out of what they thought before.
Yeah, yeah, and because, we, as you say, it's an unclear thing at this point. Are there any other races that you have been tracking that have been particularly interesting or, I guess, surprising to you? I ask because here's just an email, and I don't know if you guys have been following this, but think about that while I read this email from Carmeg. He says, I'm hoping to hear about the election contest between Sue Peters and Suzanne Dellesti, the school board District 4, the former supported by the current progressive majority on the board, the latter by the old guard. Also, there's a huge financing disparity between the two candidates. And isn't it, well, I thought it was Peters that was getting the more of the money, but I actually am not sure. Are there any other campaigns that you've been surprised about or tried?
Well, just watching that 26th district that I mentioned earlier, legislative district, I tell you what I'm surprised by. I'm surprised by how much attention it's getting, but it doesn't give you technical control.
Well, remind us what's happening.
Okay,
in that.
So in the 26th, it's Nathaniel Schlicker against Jan Angel, and it's for the Senate. And so, as you know, that two of the Democrats have gone to join the Republicans, and so this changes the numbers down there. And so there's a lot of national attention on this, a lot of state attention on this, and it's really just a sort of a humdrum legislative race in Tacoma.
Yeah. But I think part of the reason you see so much national money coming in is because, as we were talking about before, states are laboratories for experimentation on, you know, social change and all kinds of change. And Washington in particular has been, and legislative races are relatively cheap to swing. And so if you can swing control of the Senate in Washington state, then you end up with Democrats in control of both houses in Washington, potentially. Or at least you prevent, you know, you make it harder for Republicans in the Senate. And then you have the possibility of some really interesting change in Washington state, which is why I think you have outside money from liberal interests coming in. But then, of course, also why there's so much Republican money coming in to prop up Angel. The characters in this race are very interesting also, by the way. Schlicker. Schlichter.
We worked on that last week. We worked on Schlicker. That pronunciation. Schlicker.
Schlicker is a lawyer and a doctor and a state legislature member. And then Angel is a former real estate agent and kind of a down and then up again by her bootstraps sort of character.
She was on the Kitsap County Commission too.
Yeah, who has not done a whole lot legislatively in the legislature, but does say what Republicans want to hear.
Yeah, interesting. Anything about the mayor's race in Seattle? A week from now, we're gonna know. I imagine we'll know anything.
It just hit the most expensive race ever number, $2.6 million. I mean, you would expect races to get more costly every year because maybe that TV time we've been talking about gets more expensive, but just sort of the availability of money in this race has hit a record high, according to the Seattle Times story I read. And the ads are amazing right now. There are two ads that Mike McGinn has that are worth noting. In one, he mentions his values. He's standing against this skyline of the city, and he mentions his values. And one of them is he likes plowing snow or having it being plowed in some fashion, which is an interesting sort of dig at Greg Nichols from years ago, but a sort of a reference that says, see, you know, things aren't so bad under the Mike McGinnis administration. I'm taking care of the basics, the snow.
Well, that ad, it's interesting because it's all built around the phrase, I believe. And the payoff line is, I believe in Seattle. That was Charlie Stadiker's campaign slogan. He had buttons that he gave out everywhere. I believe in Seattle. I don't think it's a I didn't think that was a great idea to adopt Charlie Stadiker's campaign tactics. I think the mayor's race is fascinating because people seem to fall into two camps. One is that McGinn lost the race 3 years ago. People don't like him and they haven't really changed their mind, and that Ed Murray is going to be the acceptable alternative. The other is that it's a classic sort of David and Goliath race, but David's the mayor and he's fighting the big business interests. There was a penalty this week against the Chamber of Commerce for money that Vulcan was funneling to a pro Ed Murray PAC. He's getting national publicity for the fact that Comcast doesn't want him to be mayor because of his gigabit plan to bring the
competition, as they say,
competition to Comcast to 14 or so Seattle neighborhoods. There's this, you know, it's going to be kind of, it's the conventional wisdom race versus the David and Goliath phenomenon. And it'll be very interesting, I think. I think, you know, the polls have pretty consistently showed Murray ahead. But, I think that McGinn has done, I think, some very good things campaign wise.
By the way, in that scenario, is Mike McGinn Goliath and Murray David, and they're both in those little fur pieces?
McGinn is David and Murray is Goliath.
All right, wait, hold on to that. Let me bring Luke Burbank in. Oh. Luke Burbank is host of the podcast TBTL. He also hosts LiveWire, which runs on KUW Friday evenings. David or Goliath, Luke, which would you dress up as?
I think it's interesting that you guys are giving McGinn grief for that ad that was kind of a dig at Nichols, because do you even realize the lead he has on Nichols right now?
Yeah,
he's losing to Ed Murray, but he's destroying Greg Nichols.
What's the big story you've been following this week, or the small one?
Well, I think the big story is my disappointment in the children of Seattle and their trick-or-treating ways. Walter, you and I live in the same neighborhood. Did you have any trick-or-treaters last night?
Well, you weren't listening earlier. I already said I had zero until one moment where I had 10 8-year-olds who took pretty much most of the candy, but it was limited, and I didn't know you lived in my neighborhood.
Luke, I will say again, Luke, you got to put some pumpkins out there. You got to put some...
No, but this
is the point. We had fake gravestones. We put a speaker out there. We were playing Danny Elfman music.
Oh, my God.
We could not have sent a more clear signal to the trick-or-treaters that, now here's the problem, It takes a. You have to climb a lot of stairs to get to
my
house.
I was just going to say that.
I think I've been to this
escalator
house.
John Krakauer is writing a book about climbing the stairs to my house called Touching Heaven. So the problem is that the four kids who actually came up the stairs, when they would get to the top, they would complain about how many stairs they had to walk to get to their free candy.
Yeah, they're winded.
I think I've been to that house, and you do live in my neighborhood. But here's the thing. There is kind of maybe a new trend in trick-or-treating, which Skip alluded to, which the stores are getting into it in different U-Village, and you mentioned Madison Park. So they're beating us. They're taking the kids.
Yeah.
I like the idea that he's giving out free candy and fighting obesity at the same time.
Well, we hear so much about childhood obesity, so I feel like this is the ultimate dilemma for some of these more portly kids. We've got amazing candy, but you have to basically do a CrossFit workout to get to it. What do you do? The answer last night was don't climb up the stairs, apparently.
What'd you give out?
We had Snickers bars and Reese's peanut butter cups. And, you know, because there was such a dearth of trick-or-treaters, by the few that did come by, it was like, hey, just go for it. You know, sometimes there's that whole, you know, one piece of candy. We were just basically letting these kids run roughshod over the candy bowl when they got there. But, again, you know, in my growing up days, well, for reasons that are too boring to get into, including my very evangelical upbringing, we didn't really do Halloween or trick-or-treating. But the one foray that I had into trick-or-treating, we got one block away from our house, and this lady opened her door, and she was dressed like a witch. And it so terrified my, like, sort of, you know, protected, naive Christian brain at age, like, six that I ran all the way home and climbed under a bed, and that was it for me on trick-or-treating.
You know, you should be glad, though, now. I hear that you can take your extra candy and actually sell it back to different organizations. It used to be when we were growing up, we would bring candy to school, and it'd be collected, then it'd be donated to the unfortunates who didn't get to go out on Halloween. Now I believe you can actually sell it back, so you can get a little money back for the candy you didn't.
We're actually going to do is keep it around, and every night at about 8 o'clock, I'll tell myself this is the night that I stick to my diet, and by about 11 o'clock. I'll have horfed down about three Snickers bars, and I'll be in a shame spiral.
Yeah. Well,
how we get rid of candy at our house.
Yeah. Yeah, here too. Well, Skip brought his in. All right. Luke Burbank is host of TBTL. He's on Livewire tonight at 8 p.m. You can hear that on KUOW. Thanks, Luke. You guys got any last words for scary thoughts before the election or otherwise?
Well, I hope everybody votes, but there are some long advisory things on there that, you know, might take you a few minutes.
Well, what did you say you could also do with those advisory
back questions? Away from that part of the bill.
Because these are part of those IMIN initiatives where once it's been passed by the legislature, you can...
They're just long.
...maintain or...
Or go online and pull up the Stranger cheat sheet, and we'll guide you right through it.
All right. Thank you all. Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, also Luke Burbank. Thank you for listening. Write us with your thoughts, your comments, your angry epistles, weekinreview@kuow.org. I'm Steve Scherr. Don't forget, we'll have a little more fresh stuff, unwrapped, uncut, on the record today between 12 and 2.